Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. It was in June of 2000, almost exactly 26 years ago, that Nokia would briefly become Europe's most valuable company, accounting for a significant portion of the Finland stock market. Certainly, times have changed, and imagine what 26 years can do. I'm Jimmy Mayaha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest out of the Public Investment Corporation, one of their funds that has had more than 80 billion rands invested across 14 odd companies, has failed to deliver a return on investment. We try and make sense of that and what could be behind that. Then we have a conversation with our resident energy expert, independent energy analyst Tsepo Gadima, around the potential opportunity that exists in the electricity market and power market for hyperscalers that might want to consider South Africa as a power source. Then we have a conversation with the team at Spar Group, specifically speaking to the Spar Group Chief Executive Officer, Reza Isaacs, around the performance of that business. They released their interim results for the first 6 months of their new financial year. We're going to get a sense of how they have kicked off that year and what it is that they are looking ahead to. Then we have a conversation with Peter Major of Modern Corporate Solutions around the industrial development strategy that has been put forward by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition around beneficiation in the mining sector. It has already received some concerning remarks from the Minerals Council of South Africa. We're going to get Peter Major's thoughts on this as mining expert and see if we can make sense of this particular strategy. And then because it's Wednesday, we've got an executive lounge conversation. We have the Managing Director of Lightstone Properties, Sarah Winston, joining me in studio to give us a sense of what it is she gets up to from a career perspective and when she's not running Lightstone.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by Head of Financial Markets and Insights at FNB Wealth and Investments, Sithembile Bopela, to take a look at markets and see what we can make of them. Stay lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. It seems as though we can't get rid of this up and down movement. Yesterday was a relatively greenish calm day. Today was just a red day. Markets really trying to make sense of every bit of data that seems to be out there and every bit of data that comes in seemingly making the markets even more volatile.
Hi, Jimmy. Very good evening to you and your listeners as well. Yeah, definitely a lot of volatility out there and, you know, global market sentiments has been broadly negative. A very weak day on the JSE today. Red screens across the board. I mean, it was mostly across the board, rather industrials sort of eking out a very small positive gain at the end of the day. But I think generally, you know, equity indices are showing weakness today because of the prolonged US-Iran conflict with no resolution kind of in sight. This afternoon, U.S. markets we saw opened in the red as President Trump threatened more action against Iran, who he, you know, quote unquote, says they're taking too long, you know, in terms of reaching a deal. And so the Strait of Hormuz has now entered its third consecutive month of effective closure. And, you know, it's a big impact. We've seen Brent crude ease back below $95 a barrel on some of the positive headlines. But I think the ebb and flow, you know, isn't enough to sustain. The physical bottleneck remains real. Markets are taking a breather here and there, but at the end of the day, staying highly defensive until the ships are actually moving through the Straits again.
I don't know about you, Steve, but I've got some whiplash from how markets have been moving. I'm looking at the Brent crude price yesterday. We were celebrating dipping just below $90 a barrel. We definitely did not hold there. We're at $93 at the moment with what looks like the potential to go all the way back up to $100 a barrel. How do you make sense of these movements? How do you, from a markets perspective, from an investment perspective, even start to look at what to look for in the markets? I mean, some of these movements always almost suggest that you should be sitting on your hands and not doing anything at all.
Yeah, and I mean, when in doubt, right, then to act from a place of emotion, rather sit on your hands. But I think it's also important to look at some of the other economic indicators that we've seen. U.S. inflation came through earlier today, and that, you know, showed headline inflation accelerating 4.2% to its highest level since 2023. And it's primarily because of the war-induced energy spike. But when we sort of strip out the more volatile food and energy, the core inflation print came in a bit softer than what was feared. It came in at about 2.9%. And so I think that combination is what's keeping the market, you know, anxious, because, you know, the headline inflation comes in hot, and any hope of near-term sort of Fed rate cuts are completely now off the table. But when you look at the core inflation prints coming in less than feared, and couple that with the U.S. labor market showing resilience. I mean, we had non-farm payrolls come through last week, Friday, which printed better than expected. And so the Fed also isn't forced to sort of intervene with hikes immediately. And so I think there's a bit of a balance there, because the U.S. market, yes, there's some pressure because of the higher oil prices, but there is resilience in the economy nonetheless. And so it is one that you kind of have to keep an eye on, like it's a ping pong game, and you are having that whiplash, unfortunately, as you said.
So I'm looking at the CPI data out of the US as well. That, as you mentioned, I mean, driving some of the sentiment around how the markets have been seeing that, the softer core inflation data. I also noted that the likes of the Bank of Canada, interestingly, choosing not to adjust interest rates. Now, we know they've obviously got their own decisions and processes behind that. We know we got a slight interest rate hike. This now points towards the next big economic data point being the Fed decision out of the U.S. Do we have any idea around where this could land? Because we are now dealing with potentially a Fed that might still carry some of the old policies, might be looking at new policies, but possibly even a Fed that's not willing to be influenced by President Trump as the previous chair was.
Hopefully not willing to be influenced, because you want a central bank that's completely independent, right? But yes, I mean, all those things taken together, I think if it is just on a data dependency, which the Fed has been historically, I think that, you know, the fact that the core inflation print, again, that being kind of sustained better than what, you know, was feared by the market or what was anticipated, that gives the Fed sort of room to sort of wait it out and see how this U.S.-Iran war plays out. And hopefully, sooner that rather than later, we do have a resolution coming through. We also have the European Central Bank also coming out with the rate decision tomorrow. And of course, as you mentioned, across the Atlantic, things are also different there. And so their sort of policy decision making is influenced by very different macro factors. But there we are anticipating, you know, the key deposit rates to be lifted by 25 basis points tomorrow. Inflation in the Eurozone hit 3.2% in May, and that again was mainly due to the energy crisis. And so we've had commentary from the ECB saying that they want to act preemptively to stop inflation expectations from sort of breaking away. And so I think, you know, that echoes some of the commentary that we've heard from our own central bank, the SARB. And so I think that, you know, that it's definitely a factor, because the broader European economy has been flatlining.
Flatlining economies, data points that confuse markets, and in between all of this, we're trying to see where we land. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Stembile Bopela, the head of financial markets and insights at FNB Wealth and Investments, joining us to take a look at some of the market movements and some of the sentiment that might be in the market.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The Public Investment Corporation, Africa's largest public asset manager with assets north of 2.6 trillion rands worth of public servant funds, has an Isibaya fund that has invested a little over 88 billion rand across 15 companies and yet has managed to return nothing in terms of return on that investment. We're going to be taking a look at this. We're going to be taking a look at the PIC as it stands at the moment and trying to make sense of what might be going on there. I'm joined on the line by founder and director at Karuska Consulting, Kaya Sotole, to see if we can make sense of this. Kaya, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. What's happening at the PIC?
Well, that's a difficult question that even the PIC cannot seem to answer. So in essence, we do have an institution that unfortunately does tend to swing from one crisis to another. And obviously, over the past decade, its biggest crisis was unpacked during the Mpati Commission, which really made some damning findings and some important recommendations about how that entity should be governed and what the best, you know, structure needed to be. For a long time, we thought they were headed in that direction, but it looks like whenever difficult questions have to be answered, there are questions that leave you wondering about how exactly the mandate of the PIC is being executed versus how it should be executed and what the longer term consequences are to all of us. Because quite importantly, as one must keep reminding people, the GEPF, which is the primary client of the PIC, operates a defined benefit fund. In other words, if the PIC gets it wrong, it's the taxpayers who have to foot the bill. It's always important to remind people of that.
Kaya, we'll come back to long-term conversations in a bit. I want to take a look at the Isibaya Fund in particular. We've reached out to the PIC, to National Treasury, to try and get either spokesperson to give us a sense of what's happening there. From what we can gather, over 15 companies have been invested in. Some of them still exist today. Over 88 billion rand of those public funds that you speak of have been invested into these companies. And yet an ROI, a return on investment, has not been able to be achieved from any of these investments. How do we reconcile that just from a basic investment purpose?
Well, there's a couple of things that you need to clarify here. The Isibaya Fund is indeed where the PIC decided it needed to house its unlisted investments, and you can already understand the attraction behind that. What the PIC does is that it generally employs other asset managers to invest on its behalf, and those asset managers are competing for PIC funds, which means that if asset manager one gives us returns of 10%, asset manager two knows what the benchmark is, they will try to give us more. Now, when you then come to the same asset managers and then you say, we want to pursue a blend of economic and social objectives, that inevitably translates to a sacrifice on economic returns. Whether people like that or not, it is a fact. So naturally, it'd be very difficult to find asset managers, or rather there'd be a reluctance on asset managers to take up that mandate, knowing that it may look like they're underperforming their own peers. And the reason it would look like that is that, unfortunately, in spite of the PIC's convictions, political or otherwise, we still do not know how the social objectives must be measured. So is it a question of, if you pursue purely economic objectives, 15% as a return is the answer, but if you've been given a dual mandate, then 12% is the answer, which means 3% is an accepted haircut. We do not know that. So it would create a very problematic situation for asset managers if they had to take on this mandate, which really is one of the motivations for why the PIC had to do it internally. The problem with doing it internally, and also the problem with focusing on unlisted funds, is that we immediately lose access to the transparent information that you would get if you were an asset manager investing in listed equities, for example, because you and I can independently validate that you paid 10 rand for a share of Steinhoff when its value was 5 rand. What were you smoking? When it comes to unlisted investments, we do not have access to that information. We have to rely on the periodic returns that the PIC would publish. And unfortunately, it hasn't always been a linear reporting model where you could always track who got funded, how much they got funded for, what their returns were, and what the value of the investment is. So it's always really been a matter of, until somebody tables a question or there is a proper disclosure in the financial statements, it's never easy to track the performance of this rare fund. What we do know now is that a parliamentary member did ask the question from the finance minister, and the finance minister came back with an answer that, again, leaves a lot of people concerned about, well, couldn't we have done better? And the answer is that we could have. The question is, at what cost?
Kai, speaking of the finance minister, speaking of that long-term outlook and plan that we spoke about at the start of the conversation. I want to get your thoughts on another challenge the PIC has been plagued with. We had a chief investment officer, the chief investment officer and the PIC parted ways by way of mutual agreement. Since then, we were told we were going to be splitting that CIO role into three separate chief investment officer roles. To date, we still don't have any of those roles filled. Are we saying that the largest public asset manager on the African continent is without any of its chief investment officers?
Unfortunately, until there's an announcement that says people have been employed, the answer is that those positions have not been filled. So as I said earlier on, they kept swinging from one model to the other. Many years ago, the question of the CIO, or rather the role of the CIO, was occupied by a particular individual, and then there was a chief executive officer. When the individual who was the then CIO became the CEO, he decided to bring his old briefcase into his new office. In other words, the CEO and the CIO office were then conflated into one. That created significant problems with accountability and really the definition of where the lines of accountability were. The Budget Commission comes back and says, actually, we must go back to the old model, which is where we had the CIO separately from the CEO's office. Unfortunately, that isn't an easy job to handle. And as it turns out, the most recent CIO left his job after a very, very, very problematic and a very, very muddy process. In response to that, the PIC then said, well, actually, instead of one, we should have three CIOs to focus on what they regard as their three key business pillars. It is those three CIOs that we're still waiting for them to announce and to also be very clear about what is it that they think they will do better or do differently when they split the role into three. So until there's an announcement that says these are the three, there is indeed a vacuum.
Kaya, your final thoughts on what that vacuum means for the administration and the management of public funds?
I think the great tragedy is that even valid and legitimate deals that should be in the pipeline probably don't proceed as fluidly as they should when there are significant, you know, decision-making vacancies. And of course, there will be those that are able to administer the process, onboard transactions, but ultimately you do end up with the situation where the fluidity or the transaction flow is not as good as it can be if there are significant vacancies out there. They may be acting people, but that means that they now have to do a role that they're not employed to. The complications are quite easy to see. But I think quite importantly, it's a stability in the PIC that remains elusive. We thought they had aced it with their previous CEO and the previous CIO who seemed to have been there for the term that they should have been. At least the CEO completed his term. The CIO didn't. We were hoping that stability was going to be the answer. It doesn't look like that recipe has been perfected yet.
Certainly answers are needed, and we will continue to see if we can get those answers. Our request remains out to the Public Investment Corporation, as well as the stakeholder of the Public Investment Corporation in the form of National Treasury, to see if we can get some clarity on what seems to be unfolding at the PIC. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Founder and director at Karuska Consulting, Kaya Sithole, joining us to share his thoughts on the Isibaya Fund at the PIC that has failed to deliver a return on investment on the 88 billion rand it has deployed.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
One of our favorite energy experts, independent analyst Tsepo Radima, has come all the way to studio to discuss with us his thoughts on the hyperscaler market and how this presents potentially one of the greatest opportunities, almost a 100 billion rand opportunity for Eskom and the South African economy, at least. Tsepo, lovely having you in studio. Regadima, thank you so much for taking the time to come and visit us. It's not often we get to see you. Very interesting viewpoint. So interesting, in fact, that you wrote to the presidency around this. Tell me more. What's going on here?
Thanks, Remoyaha. It's good to see you in the studio today. Yes, I wrote to the president on the 29th and did a follow-up letter to him yesterday, because I'm saying, yes, there's a lot of talk and largely centered around great expansion, who's going to own the wires. And we are walking right past the most lucrative opportunity that is time limited. And that is in the area of taking the assets that we have, which is Eskom. Mm-hmm. You know, for the first time in 15 years, Eskom has got electricity that it cannot sell.
Mm-hmm.
But that is actually not an asset. It's a liability when you've got electricity that you can't sell, and more so, you have to sell it profitably. So I'm saying there's an opportunity, taking into account what is happening globally today. you know, we talk about AI. You know, a few years ago, there was talk about 4IR. You know, even a certain minister went and created a jacket with a 4IR on it. And then the moment that she left office, we forgot about it. But I'm saying this is the time we should take advantage of this, because South Africa is in a unique position. There's not a single country in the continent of Africa that has what we have now. That is excess power, that is the infrastructure that we have. So what I call effectively PCC, which is power, compute, connectivity. So I'm proposing, which is what I've said to the president, that we need to look at a Eskom Forge Connect. And Forge meaning that because Eskom has been in existence for so many years, more than 100 years. Forge, it means to create something that is strong and lasting, but with thoughtful intent. And that thoughtful intent is that a data center, an AI data center specifically, without electricity, it can't work. You need electricity. Now, when you're sitting with electricity, that is a result of customer migration or the exodus of your paying customers, and some of them complaining, of course, about the high prices. So the smelters, we know, you know, the long steel mill ArcelorMittal has shut down their long steel business, and then the ferrochrome smelters have put some of their smelters in idle. And even if they do open them, but they're not going to open them at full scale. So you need to have that electricity directed to a new market that I'm saying there is no risk of default, that customer will not be able to pay. But at the same time, it also unlocks a great deal of investment. Now, if you look at Eskom on its own, you look at Sentech on its own, you look at Broadband Infraco on its own, I'm proposing that bring these three together into one unit that is a state-owned, because when you bring them together, then you have got the economies of scale, you've got strength, you can be able to leverage off this infrastructure, but also be able to attract investment, that is foreign currency revenue generation. And that is of all the hyperscalers. If you talk about all the, you know, the major AI data center businesses globally, South Africa is a place that you need to look at. Why? Because there is somewhere between 650 or 720 billion US dollars budgeted this year alone to build AI data centers. China just yesterday came out with an announcement that over the next 5 years, they're going to spend $295 billion to build AI data centers. So that investment, we should be able to catch it into this country. And if you build, which is what I'm proposing, that if we are to merge all these three businesses, between now and 2030, we can build somewhere in between about 3,000 to 3,500 megawatts of data center capacity. And then increase that by the year 2035, you can have anywhere between 7,000 to even 10,000 megawatts of data center capacity. The investment, just that will then be private sector led by all these hyperscalers. You are looking at anywhere an opportunity of 635 to just over a trillion rand of investment in the next 5 years. And Eskom itself, or Eskom Forge Connect, the combined entity, has got the greatest opportunity to be able to produce the revenues and also at high margin. For me, it makes sense that this is the route that we're supposed to be taking as a nation, because the longer we delay, all those hyperscalers are going to find alternative places to invest in when actually they should be investing in our country.
And let's remember, folks, that at some point Eskom would brag to the world that we generate the cheapest electricity anywhere in the world. And if we look at how much coal we still have under the surface of the South African lands, or under the country rather, that points to the fact that we can clearly sustain this. Rekadima, before I let you go and before we run out of time, I want to get your thoughts on the commercials behind this. You touched on the fact that this could be lucrative financially for Eskom, for the economy, and that there'd be investment from the foreign direct investment side of things. How lucrative are we talking if we are to compare it with how much needs to actually be invested? What does Eskom actually need to do to unlock this?
Well, You have to bring all these three together so that you can be able to have competitiveness. You need to be able to have a unique advantage that you offer to the hyperscalers. But on their own, they don't work. So the most important thing I'm saying, let's generate a debate. Let National Treasury, let ESCOM, let the Ministry of Communications, let the Ministry of Electricity, all of them come together and we start, because this is so important for this country, for the economic fortunes of this country, that we must have a debate as to what is the process. And if what I'm proposing, you know, doesn't have merit, we kick it out. But I believe that it does have merit. So what I'm, if there was a plea to make, is to say, President, I think sponsor and initiate a forum through which this proposal can be tested, can be looked on its own merit. And when I present the economic model of this ESCOM Forge Connect, which is PCC, Power Compute Connectivity, I believe that it will be a no-brainer, because then you'll have a ESCOM that will have additional revenues between now, by the year 2035, I believe the additional revenue will be well in excess of 220 billion rand.
And that 220 billion rand, folks, could quite easily prevent South Africans from having to incur increased NERSA tariff hikes and potentially have ESCOM not have to apply for those hikes anymore. We'll see if this proposal takes off and if the presidency and the government respond to this. Ragadima, lovely having you in studio. Thank you for coming to studio. A very interesting proposal at the very least. And if anything else, this is definitely something that is needed if we're looking at the market that we find ourselves in, where there is a need for increased revenue and economic growth. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Independent energy analyst Tshepo Ragadima.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The SPAR Group released their interim results for the 6 months ended, or for their first 6 months, rather, not the 6 months ended, but for the first 6 months of their new financial year. We're going to be taking a look at these results in a bit more detail with the Chief Executive Officer at the SPAR Group, Reza Isaacs. He joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of that performance. Mr. Isaacs, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Congratulations are in order. You and I have not had the privilege of speaking since you've assumed the role. I imagine it was a bit of an unexpected turn of events with the change of leadership, but congratulations. And nonetheless, on the numbers side, how are you and the team finding the first 6 months of the year?
Jimmy, firstly, thank you for having me on the show, and thank you for the congratulations. It certainly wasn't on the bingo card for 2026, but here we are, and it's been quite a 90 days. But just to back to your question, the first half has been tough. There's no doubt about it. I mean, earnings, headline earnings down 50%, 55%, 54%, and SA margin at circa 1%. There's a few bright spots in there, it's our Irish performance, our working capital management. And we manage the sale of AWG, which is our UK our UK business, and that's the last part of the European cleanup. So the portfolio is focused on SA and Ireland, but we've got let's just say foundational work to do in the groceries and liquor business in South Africa.
Riza, can we take a look at that cleanup? Obviously, this predates your term as chief executive. I remember catching up with your predecessor, Angelo Swartz, around the exit out of Europe, the exit from Poland, from the UK, from Ireland, as you mentioned. Take us through, from a strategy perspective, where you now sit coming into the role, having to manage partly the cleanup, but also charting a new way forward effectively for the SPAR Group.
Yeah. So just to be clear, we haven't exited Ireland. We've exited Poland, Switzerland, and the UK business. So Ireland remains very much part of the portfolio, and currently, I mean, in the past 6 months, under very, you know, under difficult trading conditions, it still managed to grow the top line and deliver a 3% margin. So it's a great business with a great team. It's certainly not our intention to exit that business. And our focus is entirely on Ireland and South Africa currently. We've got a JV interest in Sri Lanka. But that's very small at the moment, and it consumes no management time and no capital. We're supporting growing that business in a country where 20% of food retail is formalized. But otherwise, the focus is entirely in South Africa, and an outside focus on the groceries and liquor business.
Riza, I want to get your thoughts on the stabilization efforts from a business perspective. Obviously, the KZN stabilization program essential towards turning the business in the right direction. Alongside that, obviously, the business looking at, like you, as you mentioned, the joint ventures and your overall growth strategies, the wholesale business and the wholesale focus coming into the next chapter of the business. Take us through how those moving parts are shaping your 6 months. And while we're looking at that, I want to take a look at perhaps something more in line with your own personal journey, having to navigate leading a business that is dominated in KZN. You were based in the Western Cape at one point. How are you seeing the South African dynamic as a whole, having worked across the country?
Yeah, so in terms of the SA business, and actually the group as a whole, I think one of my first tasks was to stabilize the leadership team and the management team. And I'm a firm believer in putting people in the right people, you know, in the right place and holding them and empowering them, but holding them accountable for delivery. So, you know, the big appointments that we made was Megan Paidigadu, who was COO, a very experienced CFO, who was COO at SPAR, has moved back into the CFO role, taken over from myself. And she doesn't just bring CFO experience, she brings turnaround experience to the group. We appointed Jerome Jacobs, a very experienced SPA person, 30 years in the business, MD of the North Rand division, into the role of groceries and liquor managing director. And he's firmly based in KZN. And that was something that we were missing. We didn't replace Max Oliver when he left. And then we appointed a new CMO in John Bradshaw. And obviously, marketing, promotions, brand, very important for SPAR. We spend a huge amount on that, and you know, we have an opportunity to reposition the brand, get the maximum out of our marketing expenses, and support the retailers with growth. As far as the SA dynamics and, you know, me being based, I am based in Cape Town, but it's really about the team. We are a decentralized business. We have, you know, six big centers that we operate out of, you know, three inland and three coastal. We obviously have the Irish business. We have the Sri Lankan business. And we have teams around the country. So we operate, you know, from wherever we are needed. And I do an extreme. I mean, I do lots of travels. So I've been to Ireland. I've been to spent a bit of time in Johannesburg. I've spent, an outsized amount of time in KZN. But it's and so does the team. But I think the key is that the groceries and liquor team, has a leader that is based in KZN, and that is absolutely the case.
Reza, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on what, for you, seems to be the biggest challenge confronting the SPAR Group at the moment. Obviously, restructuring is never easy, and rebuilding and resetting is never easy, especially with a business the size of the SPAR Group. What do you feel could potentially be the biggest challenge for the group at the moment?
Look, I the business is a special business. I have to say I've come to appreciate this business more and more. It is a business that, in a way is very simple. It needs to have operational excellence. It needs to buy smartly. It needs to, warehouse goods. It needs to distribute efficiently, and then it needs to manage a brand and do effective marketing, and in so doing, it needs to support the retailers. We are the second biggest grocery business at retail in Southern Africa. We operate out of six countries in Southern Africa. The model is suited to South Africa, that with diverse communities, with informal retail, with independent retail, and a one size fits all, retail chain doesn't necessarily achieve that. So I have absolute belief in the model. I think for us, it is basically, and this may sound like, cliche, but we need to get back to basics. We need to get back to being, the best at what we do, and focus on the basics. I think we've been distracted by our international expansion. We've been distracted by SAP implementation that didn't go to plan. We spent a lot of money on that, and it's created, balance sheet and other challenges for us. That's taken up an inordinate amount of management attention. So we need to get back to what we do best, and that's, being the best wholesaler that can support our retailers and independent retail in the country.
Getting back to basics and ensuring that the business resets the fundamentals that need to be reset if the success of the business is to be attained. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Wish you all of the very best, Reza, to you and the team as you turn the business back on the right track. Chief Executive Officer at the SPAR Group, Reza Isaacs, joining us to take a look at the first 6 months of the year and what it is that they're doing as a business.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
So, a new industrial development strategy document has been published by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition this week, taking a look at the mining sector and introducing proposals around conversations such as beneficiation, amongst other things. These proposals have garnered quite the reaction from the mining sector. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with our resident mining expert, also Director for Mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, Peter Major. He joins me on the line now to see if we can make sense of this. Uncle Peter, lovely having you on the show. As always, thanks so much for taking the time. What do you make of this new strategy that's being put forward by the DTIC?
Look, we've seen so many of these strategy documents come and go that at first we just say, oh, here's another one. The problem is, each of these things seems to be designed to hinder the mining industry and to hinder industrial growth in South Africa. And we know countries that aren't growing are dying. Countries that aren't growing, the people are getting poor, they're getting unruly, crime is probably going to go up. And all there's lots of negatives with no growth. There's lots of positives with pro-growth. So why this country, why this government we've got doesn't want to implement growth policies is beyond me. But if you've laden the mining industry with thousands of rules and regulations and policy changes in the past 25 years, and now you're trying to link your industrial strategy to that, it's just a load too big for mining companies to carry, and we're going to continue to see declining mining production, increased layoffs, and no new investment. So I haven't read through the 45 pages yet, Jimmy, but just to link it to beneficiation, it was ANC policy that destroyed the beneficiation our mining industry had built up over 100 years, and they've destroyed pretty much ISCOR and some of the other steel companies. So how can the same government this put all these policies that have destroyed beneficiation? Are they the people that can now increase beneficiation? It just doesn't make sense.
Uncle Peter, I want to take a look at exactly the objectives that are being put forward here. According to the strategy document, it seeks to address the challenges that have been plaguing the mining sector, amongst those deindustrialization, a weak economic growth, and declining industrial capacity. Exactly the three things that you mentioned that this policy seeks to further exacerbate. How do we reconcile where the state of the mining industry is now with what is being proposed and what actually needs to be done?
There are a complete different ends of the spectrum, and you don't need economic geniuses, and there's a lot of them out there for the last 150 years, to tell you that more government is usually negative for growth. More government is usually negative for investment and for return on investment. So the less government you have, the better it is for economic growth, the better it is to attract investment. And the less policy you have, you know, people can't even follow the Ten Commandments. How the heck are they going to follow 1,000, 2,000 different regulations? So, yeah, we want to square this circle. How can we help mining? Well, first of all, there's a lot of good writers out there, from Hume Scholes to Michael Avery, Rob Herzog, you know, Anthea Jeffrey. These are people with decades of successful experience with multiple degrees and track records. And they point out how it's our industrial policy and our economic policy that creates an environment that either hinders mining or helps mining. So, and we've seen it with the cadastre system in mining. If you have no way of keeping track of who has a license, then how can you expect other people to come in and purchase licenses and invest in companies that have a license? And if you have a railroad system that's unreliable and expensive, why would people want to start mines when they can't export their product, when they can't send the coal out or the chrome out? And we can look at beneficiation. The first thing it involves is electricity. And we've had the most horrendous electricity prices increased probably any country in the world the last 25 years. Now, these are governments' macroeconomic policies. These are governments' policies that affect the environment that mining companies have to work in. And so if you can barely economically get material out of the ground, the odds are you have no chance of making a profit trying to beneficiate it. And again, I want to keep repeating, we had a lot more beneficiation 30, 40 years ago than we've got now. Much, much more, because the environment was conducive for it, and now it's not.
Uncle Peter, you're not the only one to express these concerns. The Minerals Council of South Africa put out a statement as well expressing concern around the strategy that has been put forward here by the DTIC. If we are to talk about beneficiation, and we have been talking about beneficiation for the longest of time, as it stands at the moment, what would be the best value proposition for putting forward the case of beneficiation? How do we achieve beneficiation if the legislation is not the way to do it?
Well, get rid of the legislation. That's the first thing. If you just got rid of all this legislation, you'd probably have a boom like never before, or like a boom we had 100 years ago or 50 years ago. When the gold price was flying in the 60s and 70s, mining companies went out of their way to diversify. They went out of their way to beneficiate. Why? Because they didn't want to hand out a product that they were realizing 50 or 80 or 90% of the full value, the world market value. All mining companies want to realize as much value. They don't need a gun to their head to beneficiate if it's even remotely possible. Now, the more involved government is in our industry, the more rules and regulations they make, the more policies they make, these are just additional burdens. So Government doesn't have to come up with a genius policy. They just have to reduce the policies and regulations they got. They should be an umpire. They shouldn't be writing the rules of the game. They're an umpire that just keeps people honest. So I don't know how to ask a government to undo it, but every now and then you'll get a president in a country that does just throw regulations out. You know, Zambia and DRC, they threw out a lot of these, almost all of their mining regulations that had been constructed in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. They threw them out at the end of the 90s, and they started with a cleaner slate. So yes, I think that's the best way. Government just must throw out all the regulations and start with the bare minimum and just be an umpire.
Start over, start on a clean slate, get it right and learn from all the things of the past. Perhaps that would be an industrial strategy worth considering. We will see whether or not that is taken into account and how this conversation shapes up. Certainly a lot of the industry has already expressed their discontent with where things are headed as it currently stands. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Mining Director at Modern Corporate Solutions, Peter Major, joining us to take a look at the latest proposal by the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition on industrial development strategy as it relates to the mining sector.
Executive Lounge, where top leaders share their business insights and life lessons on SAFM.
Relax. You're okay. Your new Volvo plug-in hybrid will get you there and back again. And there again. And back again. Because you're at least 80 kilometers of electric range away from having to worry about petrol. Or the battery. Which comes with an 8-year warranty. But it will keep you going for much, much longer than that. Test drive a Volvo plug-in hybrid.
It is Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday. We get to speak to leading executives and get to know them a little bit better. This week's executive has come all the way to studio to give us a sense of what it is that she gets up to when she's not running Lightstone Properties. She's the managing director at Lightstone Properties, Sarah Winston. She's joining me in studio to get to know her a little bit better. Sarah, lovely having you in studio. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
That's a Scottish accent, isn't it?
It is indeed a Glaswegian accent. I'm trying my best so that your listeners understand what I'm saying tonight. But you may need Google Translate. Let's see.
How does Glasgow come to Johannesburg? What happens there?
It was a love story, believe Ooh. It or not. Yes, I met my South African-born husband in Australia and he convinced me Joburg was the place to be. That was back in 2012 and here I am.
Still here.
Still here and absolutely loving it. Love South Africa, love the people, love the energy. Yeah, it's an incredible place.
What about the work that you do allows you to experience so many different places? I mean, you touched on Australia. You and I were having a conversation and you mentioned you just came from Asia. What part of your work gives you this wonderful...
So I guess we probably need to go back a little bit to say I haven't really had a kind of linear work path. Mm-hmm. If you'd asked me when I was a kid, I wanted to be a fashion designer. But then my guidance teacher said that wasn't a great idea. I was very good at numbers and I was very good at problem solving. So I found myself on the accounting and finance route. Mm-hmm. I then trained with PwC, then moved to London, wanted to experience the big bad world of finance, was in leveraged finance, pre-2008 global financial crisis,
wow.
Height of the leveraged finance market. Great place to really see where data and finance meet. And how good data can lead to really great lending decisions. And then from there, once 2008 did hit, my boss said to me, now's a great time to travel if you ever wanted to. So I set off on some travels around Asia because I'd always wanted to explore the world a bit and landed up in Australia working for Commonwealth Bank and the finance team out there. And then met my husband and came to Joburg. And now travel is not so much part of work. I mean, I obviously travel locally within South Africa, but whenever I get the opportunity, I still love to go and scratch that itch.
Between property and finance, which of the career paths or perhaps the sectors would you say you've enjoyed the most and why?
Oh, it's so hard. I think when I came to South Africa, joining Lightstone was quite left field for me because I'd expected probably to go back into banking. I was a banker and identified as one. But then at the time, they were about 6 years old and were doing some really exciting stuff in the property market. And I loved that intersection of data, finance and property. I thought it was really interesting. And the thing that I loved about what they were doing was the tools that they provided to banks and estate agents ultimately actually helped the person on the street get a better home loan for their property, get better access to information. And I just thought that was wonderful. That was something that kind of gave me my passion for property. And since then, I guess I've been now in the property industry in South Africa for the last 13 years. And it's a fascinating market. It really is. And it's very hard to predict. So don't ask me to give you any predictions.
No, it definitely is. And it has been undergoing some serious changes as well with everything that's been happening. Sarah, take me through some of your global adventures from a food perspective.
A food perspective. Oh, I love food. Probably travel's my first love. Food's the second one.
Thought so.
Yeah, so I've travelled extensively through Europe. You can't travel through Europe and not love the Italian food. I mean, I think that's like the high point for me out of Europe. But then recently we travelled, my husband and I did an amazing trip through Asia. And I really expected my favourite part was going to be Japan and the food there. But I was saying to you before this interview, South Korea blew my mind. Mm. The food there, the Korean barbecues. South Africans think that they've got it down pat when it comes to braise. I hate to tell you, the South Koreans are phenomenal when it comes to their barbecues. Unbelievable.
Ooh, that's a bold claim. That's a bold claim. South Africans out there are ready to challenge this. I will put together a team and we will fly to South Korea and make sure that this is settled.
A braai-off. That's it.
That's it. That's
I'm sure
it.
They would be up for it.
And I suppose who better than a Scotsman to adjudicate this, a neutral party,
I'd
so
be
to speak.
Very happy to. Very happy to.
Sarah, what do you enjoy most about what you get to do on a day-to-day basis? Take me through your diary, your program, not necessarily from a work perspective, but what part of your day do you enjoy the most?
So every single morning, Monday to Friday, I start my day being abused by my trainer, my wonderful trainer, Debbie. I do a lot of strength training. And the reason I do it is really to give, well, because I'm getting a bit older and I need to, work on my strength, but also it's just to clear the mind in the morning. I think it's so important. It de-stresses you and puts you in a great mindset to start the day. I then need to get my little boys off to school, and that's always fun and challenging. And then I guess every day looks a bit different. It can be client engagements. It's a lot of supporting my team. It can be a lot, what I've realised being MD is a lot of the time it's dealing with a lot of the issues that come up and how you try and create the right environment and remove any blockers to make sure that people can actually get on and do their job that they have to do that day. But that's quite fun too, because again, as I said, I loved kind of problem solving, and that's ultimately what it is. It's daily problem solving. And in the evenings, it's more, let's just relax, read a book, love a good whodunit, love a bit of a murder mystery, again, bit of problem solving, see if I can work it out early on. And yeah, chill with my boys.
Speaking of those boys, have you solved the problem of which accent they're using at the moment?
My boys, you could not tell where they're from. So they're born and bred in South Africa. Mm-hmm. I call them little Afro-Scots. They have a complete blend of a South African and Scottish accent, and no one can place them. The poor things.
And when you travel with the family and you're in Scotland, do they kind of gravitate towards the Scottish side of pronunciations and things, and perhaps...
So it's more words that they pick up. So they wouldn't say small, they'll say wee. And there's lots of little strange idiosyncrasies that I have that they've definitely picked up. In fact, my youngest was in speech therapy, and his speech therapist used to call me and say, just need to check if this is a Scottish thing or a speech impediment. I think that sums it up.
Well, that's certainly one way of looking at it. Unfortunately, we are out of time. We're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. Sarah, it's been lovely getting to know you. Thank you for coming into studio to give us a sense of what it is that you get up to and your day. Sarah Winston, Managing Director at Lightstone Properties, joining us in studio this week for our Executive Lounge.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means while we continue this conversation in studio, Greg Hoss and the SAFM News team are standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. They will, of course, be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team, which means from my side, good night.